Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 6th of October 2013. My name is T.R.P. Watson, and this week I'm joined by Phil from the West End Whingers, Gareth James and Web Cowgirl. We're now going to talk about The Commitments, which is a musical at the Palace Theatre based on Roddy Dawes' best-selling novel from, I think, 1987. It was made into a film by Alan Parker in 1991, and I presume that this leans quite heavily on the film. The Commitments has gained some extra interest recently because of a film and a musical called Once, the music for which was co-written by Glenn Hansard, who originally appeared in The Commitments. So, Phil, what did you think about The Commitments?
Well, on the whole, pretty positive. I thought the show had a huge amount of energy. I mean, I saw it probably about 3 days into preview, so it was quite early. And yeah, some of it was a bit ragged around the edges at that point. But actually, I think some of that raggedness kind of worked for it, and I think they should try and keep it in. And it's strange for me to say that, because I think there is something about the rawness of the way that they perform. And obviously, at first, they are a band which are supposed to be not quite there. They're not very good. That's quite a difficult one to pull off. It's a bit like Sally Bowles in Cabaret. You know, she's not supposed to be a very good singer. But I think what really, really makes this show is Killian Donnelly, who plays the band frontman Deco. His performance, I thought, was so staggeringly good, particularly in the second act, that people are going to come out talking about him. He's probably going to be up for an Olivier Award. I'm sure it's a given, really. And I think, actually, the show is going to be a huge success. I think also, because people of sort of my age who can afford to go to the theatre now were sort of the kind of people who went to see The Commitments when the film came out. Although I think they say that this is based on the book rather than the film, but then everybody says that these days. And I think there's a huge market for it. It is a sort of a jukebox musical, really, whatever anybody says. It's a bloody good jukebox musical. I liked the songs more than I expected to. I mean, of course, they are classics in it. And it's not necessarily my kind of type of song, but actually the ones that they have in this are so good and they're so well performed. And you also get sort of frustratingly brief snatches of things like Master and Servant and I Want to Take You Higher, Don't You Want Me, Tubular Bells, when they're doing the sort of the audition process for the band. I'd love to have heard more of those, but I can see why you don't. I think that when I saw it, it was probably a bit too loud, and some of the music at times was a little bit muddy because of that loudness, but I'm sure that all settled down. I liked the set by Sutra Gilmore, who seems to be doing everything these days. Yeah, I mean, I think on the whole, it was a jolly good night out. And also, it was quite funny. It made me laugh quite a lot.
It is, of course, directed by Jamie Lloyd, who's had quite a lot of success this year. I mean, taking over, having a residency at the Trafalgar Studios and a rather good Macbeth early on. Gareth, what did you think about this?
Yes, I mean, for me, it's Jamie Lloyd's fourth hit in about 6 months, really. I think what I like most about it is it isn't a sort of West End musical, really. It's got kind of fringe sensibilities. Even though it's in a big theatre, it's got an edginess about it. And as Phil said, a kind of rawness about it that I really, really liked. And I think part of that might be a largely unknown and largely Irish cast, which I think, I mean, you know, their kind of energy is quite infectious. And the idea of these half-price previews, I think, is inspired because the cast are getting, you know, full houses. The cast are getting a great experience and really kind of, you know, bedding this show in. I saw it on Tuesday, which I think was a bit after Phil. And I thought it was just, frankly, you know, press ready on Tuesday night. So the cast are getting great experience. The audience is getting great experience. They're going out and there's lots of word of mouth. And I think, you know, it's a great idea to sort of properly reduce previews to encourage people to come in and have a good time. And I think it's working for them. I think having Roddy Doyle adapt his own book stroke film for the stage is a very good idea, because I think what that means is the kind of the essence and the spirit of what he was saying, I think, comes over on stage. I felt... At times, it sort of seemed a bit rushed. You know, one minute you're in the auditions, next minute the band's playing. But I kind of stopped caring about that after a while, really, because I was having too good a time to, you know, to be too pedantic about it. And it is a great soundtrack. It is played extremely well. I completely agree with Phil that Killian Donnelly is just sensational, and quite how he's going to do that. 7 times a week, I think he's going to do it. I think they're having Monday off and he's missing Tuesday or something.
Quite
how he's going to do that, I really don't know, because it seems to me to be vocally a very demanding thing to do. And there's also a superb performance by Joe Woolmer, who plays this skinhead bouncer who eventually becomes the drummer. I think it's a great performance. And there's some lovely running gags. There's, you know, the auditions that Phil mentions, there's a wonderful running gag about a New Romantics auditionee, which I thought was just great. And at one point, I think the saxophone player has a bit of a dalliance with jazz, and that leads to some terrific sniping at jazz as being a sort of intellectual middle-class kind of music, as opposed to soul being the sort of the working-class music. I just thought it was just a lot of fun, lots of energy, lovely sort of rawness about it, very different to every other Midwestern musical in terms of its kind of style and sensibilities, and I think it's going to be a huge hit. I really do think it's going to be a huge hit. So very welcome. I think I don't think it is a jukebox musical really, because I think it is telling this story of this kind of working class North Dublin, and I think it's, even though it's using this, you know, this great soundtrack, I don't think it's a jukebox musical in the same way. I mean, it's more like the Jersey Boys, I think, in a way. The Jersey Boys tells personal stories of the members of the band, and this is telling a sort of generic stories of the people of a part of a city, really, which, as they say in the play, is the sort of, you know, islands, I won't repeat it because it's the N-word, but it's. I think it's kind of telling a story of a type of people, which is not, you know, which is, I think, less like the jukebox musical as it's come to be known, really. But great night out. And Sutra Gilmore, again, as Phil says, has, you know, turned up these sort of tower blocks, basically, you know, all around the stage, and people come out of them and peer down from them, which is a, you know, it's a great setting. And the only thing I would say about that is you do need to sit further back. Sitting in the first few rows of the stalls does strain your neck a little bit. Anyway, excellent night.
I think also to see somebody singing, I heard it through the great line while eating a bag of chips is pretty impressive to me. And the headbutt. The headbutt is incredibly well done. I mean, it's quite shockingly well done.
Yeah. But it does have that rawness, doesn't it? It does have that kind of edginess where I didn't think there was a fault in the casting. I mean, the dad was great. I mean, the dad sort of turns from being cynical into being very supportive, and all the sort of people in the band, the three girls, were really good. I mean, it was just a very, very well cast production.
I agree with you as well, what you're saying, because you saw it probably about a week after me, in that apart from a few little things, it felt pretty ready for press night then. And as you say, the rawness, kind of the slightly raggedness, sort of worked in its favour in a strange way. And I just want to mention, and I meant to, because you've already mentioned it, but the half-price preview thing, that's how it used to be, and I think that's how it should be.
Absolutely.
And they are getting it ready, but they're packing their people in, and people are going to, as you say, word of mouth is going to be really good. I can't really see how this is going to fail.
No. And I think what's interesting is that I couldn't find any signs in the programme credits of any of the usual suspects in terms of West End producers. You know, none of the obvious people like Sonia Freeman and Act and all of those are there. So it's produced by a company called The Commitments Limited. So unless they're hiding behind The Commitments Limited, which is a bit unusual, I think this is a kind of fresh approach. This is not being produced by West End, you know, by classic West End producers. And that could be why you've got this half-price preview idea, because that's something that nobody else has done for a while, as you say. And I think that's very welcome, because I think it, you know, you shouldn't be paying £5 less than normal prices for a preview of what is effectively work in progress. And look at the benefit of it, because the cast are getting full houses to try out their show on, and it's working. So please, West End producers, note.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go back to this, because this is the way. If you really want your show to bed in, that's the way to do it.
But actually, funnily enough, this show felt pretty bedded in when I saw it, probably third or fourth preview. So it's sort of, I don't know what that's kind of quite lucky. It could have been a terrible show, in which case I would have still have blogged about it, despite the fact it's half price. But I would still applauded them for that, for taking that decision. Fortunately for them, it's actually in really, really great shape.
But it was the third or fourth full house, though, Phil. You see, that's the thing. It was the third or fourth. Yeah. Full house, not a sort of third or fourth performance to a half empty, half enthusiastic audience.
Yeah.
So that kind of, I really do think that lifts the game. I really think that lifts the game of the cast and everyone involved, really. And of course, for the audience, it's always better being in a full house, particularly for a show like that, which is about energy and enthusiasm. So everyone wins, it seems to me.
I think people really won't want to go on Tuesdays, though, because they want to see, I mean, the understudy may be very, very good, or the stand-in may be very good, but he is so good. That's who people are going to want to see.
I thought it was a bit odd they've chosen a Tuesday for his night off, because it does mean he's going to do 7 performances on 5 consecutive days, doesn't it?
Yeah, but I suppose it means he gets 2 days off because they're not playing Mondays, I assume, because they're doing 2 shows on Sunday. Again, I think that's a good decision. It means they're doing, I mean, it means he's got to do 5 shows between Friday and Sunday evening, which is, that's quite something.
I would have thought you'd break the ride. I thought you'd have sort of taken your show off kind of halfway through, as it were, to... Yeah, to give yourself some breathing time, but there you go. That's.
I mean, it's funny. I'm really against performers not doing 8 shows a week, but even when I came out, I thought, how is he going to do that 8 shows a week? So when I looked and saw that he doesn't do Tuesdays, I thought, well, okay.
Yeah, that was the first thing I said. I said, how on earth is he going to do this? Because he does invest a huge amount of energy and particular vocal energy into the performance. Anyway, I think we've all agreed. It's a great
thumbs up, then, isn't it? Really,
about the way the music's played. I assume the band, once they get together, all play their own instruments. But how are they doing the rest of it? How are they doing sort of the musical numbers, like when they're doing the auditions, or is it everybody comes in and plays their piece, and there isn't any sort of music without people actually deliberately performing?
I'm glad you said that, because actually you can't see the joins. There is an offstage band as well as the on stage, the actors playing their instruments as well. And actually it's very difficult to know when it's on stage and offstage. And I think that's another very good thing about the show, is they've kind of blended that without it seeming in any way artificial or cheating or anything. I couldn't tell when it was on stage or off stage, personally.
No, I couldn't either. I mean, when the guy was playing the piano, I wasn't sure whether it was him or somebody playing off stage. And also at the end, when you leave and the band is still playing, there's nobody on the stage. So there is a band, although they didn't take a bow, whoever that band was, which seems strange.
I only knew they were there because I saw them in the programme. That's the only reason I knew there was an offstage band. Otherwise, I think you would think it was...
I thought, given the way the set opened up and things like that, it would have opened up and we would see them and they would have got a huge round of applause. But,
But they were kind of topping up, I guess. They were sort of, you know, so they weren't... I mean, there were times, I think, when it was basically the actor musicians that were performing the whole number.
We're now going to talk about Scenes from a Marriage, which is a stage adaptation of Ingmar Bergman's 1970s television series, which has been adapted by Joanna Murray-Smith and directed by Trevor Nunn. This was first performed at the Belgrade Theatre in Coventry back in 2008, when the main two characters were played by Ian Glenn and Trevor Nunn's then-wife, Imogen Stubbs. So there's a certain amount of history here, which I wonder if it gets translated across. In this production, the main characters, Johan and Marianne, are played by Mark Baisley and Olivia Williams, with other characters being played by Shane Atwell, Melanie Jessop and Aisling Sands. Web Cowgirl, what did you think about this, and tell me more?
I'm quite familiar with the cinematic work of Ingmar Bergman, and I thought I had a pretty good idea of what I might expect from Scenes from a Marriage. Do you go in expecting it to be cheerful and happy and lovey-dovey? Well, in the very first scene, the two lead characters, Marianne and Johan, are being interviewed about their perfect marriage. And it's like in a Chekhov play when someone sort of casually mentions, and then there's this gun, and you know that the play can't end without this being dealt with, that it's not really going to be possible for this marriage to be perfect. And I liked this watching it all unravel approach, and it seemed very honest that rather than doing it in the style that Ibsen does, in which there's basically one day or two in which everything comes to a climax, Bergman has written this much more naturally, so that there's just a series of things that over time cause the two lead characters to realize that they aren't in a perfect marriage. In fact, they may have been imagining that their marriage was good from the very beginning, possibly because they never actually talked to each other about how they felt. There's so many issues that are very realistic in terms of how couples deal with their lives. There's questions of sex drive, of communication, of children. You don't see, you know, they don't talk about their family. Oddly, career isn't actually something that comes up, because both of these people have good careers. And I thought it was interesting that you didn't see Johan turn on Marianne and say, oh, well, you abandoned the children so that you could have a career or something like that, because that seems to be sort of like where these conversations would go these days. But I wasn't, despite the fact that it was very realistic in some ways, I was not able to buy in the reality of these characters. Both Mark Baisley and especially Olivia Williams started off the show in a sort of hyper-emotional, overly on state that, to me, just clearly identified them as, hi, we're actors doing a play. And although the overall emotional level of the play actually rose up to meet them by the end of the first act, and certainly by the end of the second, I felt distant from what was going on. But that's a good thing in some ways, because what was happening was occasionally very harsh. And I was just sort of able to sit there, as it were, eating my popcorn and just kind of enjoying the pleasure of a story taking place in front of me. But I wish, though, that Olivia Williams had been able to perhaps find more levels of depth in her character, because I felt she was very sort of like one-note tragic victim. And I also, I don't think it'll be put on her, though, because I as Jessica Rabbit says, she's just written that way. I think that perhaps it's a case of Ingmar Bergman not really understanding women, and maybe it's just his view of women, that they're very emotional as compared to men being more distant. So I think maybe she just didn't have the opportunity to find depth in a character when it simply wasn't written. What she does find, though, over the course of the show is a reconnection to her sex drive, which sort of leads to like the ultimate ending, in which basically, to not give anything away, everybody's shagging and everybody's happy. And I couldn't buy it. And I think also that this was Ingmar Bergman's vision of what a happy marriage would look like, is that everybody's shagging and nobody's talking about anything. So it left me with a little bit of a bitter taste in my mouth, but I had to ascribe it mostly to the author and not nearly as much to the production itself, which I thought was good and, you know, was worth a watch.
The original television program was 281 minutes, apparently. So this has been cut down quite severely. I mean, we're talking about, what, 120 minutes. So we've lost a substantial part of it. So I can't entirely blame Ingmar Bergman, although you might be right, because I haven't seen the original. But it might also be Joanna Murray Smith's adaptation that it's not a good cut. I found some of the early scenes really quite tedious in places. It was almost as if, I always like using the phrase diagrammatic, which is not really something that I can explain, other than to say it's as if you've worked out what they need to say, worked out what you need to convey in a scene, but you've not actually put it in the words that your characters would, in the way that the characters would say it. So you haven't got to that bit yet. You've got what they're going to say, but you haven't really put it into the characters' voices and made, you know, created how the characters would say it. And I thought that was troubling in the early scenes. And for me, it really didn't come to life until towards the end of the first act, really, where the marriage begins to break down. And then I thought the acting was a lot better. I mean, you have something like 12 really quite short scenes in the first act, and then you've got this in the next two acts, you've only got a sort of three or four much longer scenes, and those were, I thought, a lot better, and got their relationship really, after their relationship had broken down, trying to find each other again and trying to finding out whether or not they felt enough to get together again or whether they should stay separate. And I thought those worked a lot better. And there's a really quite stunning scene when they're trying to, shall we say, discussing their divorce, which is quite shocking on stage. And I really thought was particularly well done. But the early part of the play I really didn't get on with, and I was thinking I really need to stick a spike into Mark Baisley's head during the first scene. So it's I just had that reaction to them.
But you had to love how arrogant he was, and then saying, "Oh, but I'm really being arrogant, aren't I?" And it was like, yes, yes, you are. But you know what's interesting is I didn't anticipate at the beginning that he would actually be brought down, that his arrogance would be taken down a notch, and he absolutely was. So in some ways, his first speech when he was being so insufferable was, you know, basically like a setup for a great tragedy. But I didn't realize that. But I have to say, given the general modesty that is approved of in Britain, to listen to someone big themselves up like that was pretty darn funny.
We're now going to talk about The Boys from Syracuse, which is on at the Union Theatre in Southwark. This is Richard Rodgers and Lawrence Hart's 1938 musical, based on The Comedy of Errors, which again is also based on a play by Plautus. Web Cowgirl, tell me more about it.
Interestingly enough, I actually didn't walk into this show recognizing that it was The Comedy of Errors. So I didn't know a thing about it other than it was Rodgers and Hart, and I thought it would be lovely to see a musical by a top-tier American writing team of the golden age of American musicals. And this was certainly a very popular show when it was written. But if you know anything about the sort of evolution of musical theater, when this was written in the 30s, they were still evolving into the more fully character-driven musical, and in a period where it was still kind of frequently done as reviews, in which there were a series of songs that were sort of loosely connected. So this has, of course, a very strong story behind it. It is one of, I think, the least funny of Shakespeare's comedies, involving mistaken identities, and not just one, but two pairs of twins who look so much alike that you can't tell which is which. And this, apparently, the reason why this was adapted for stage in the first place is because, who was it? Hart had a brother who was always up for roles against another actor who was basically doing the same kind of shtick he was. So he decided that instead of having them both competing for the same roles, he'd make a play in which they could both be playing basically the same role, but with slightly different names. And this is actually a little bit more confusing than Shakespeare, because both of the guys have exactly the same name. So the two twins, both of the servants are Dromio, and both of the young men are called Antipholus. And it's got everybody, it's not done in any sort of modern dress. Everybody is wearing the bargain basement version of Greek robes, which I think winds up being kind of challenging for the women at times. And if you focus on it as being a play that is providing a structure for songs, I think it provides a pretty good evening. We've got some really good talent. I think the women are especially strong. Adriana, the wife of of the Antipholus, who is married and actually lives in Ephesus, has just a gorgeous voice, which is nicely shown off in Falling in Love with Love, in which she explains that she basically needs to be nice to her husband and not complain about things in order to get him to love her. And her sister, Luciana, is played by Kara Dudgeon, who's got that perfect ingenue look, just very light, very dreamy, very waiting for love to happen. And when she meets the visiting Antipholus, Aaron Hayes Rogers, as Antipholus of Syracuse, you believe that she's been, you know, waiting to fall in love. Unfortunately, the other Antipholus, who's carrying on with a courtesan behind his wife's back, isn't actually as sympathetic and doesn't really seem to have a lot of chemistry. But I feel this show was really, really carried by the women. And there's a song called Sing for Your Supper, which kind of reminded me of the Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy of Company B, but it had those really, really tight harmonies, which I think were big in popular music at the time. And for that number, we had Adriana, the cook, Luce, and Luciana singing together about how if you're a woman, you can learn from the birds, and if you sing, you'll get your meals for free. So basically, if you're pretty, some guy will take care of you. And it could have been kind of like offensive, but actually, it was such a lovely number that I wasn't so upset by the sexism. Overall, well, I should mention this is all a song and dance show, so it's not just singing, but the dancing wasn't really what this was about. There was a lot of good movement. They filled the space pretty well, but fortunately they focused on the singing, which I think was very much worth listening to. And the women were much more sympathetic than the men, but what's interesting to me for watching this play is comparing it to the original. I find the comedy of errors grating. The servants are beaten. The men are rude and dismissive to the women. But actually, Adriana is much more of a shrew in this play than she was in the musical. And by toning it down a little bit and taking out some of the ridiculous sexuality and making it all fakey Greeky, I was able to laugh at the scenes where the men were abusing their servants that I found so difficult to stomach before. And the sexual element with, you know, being concerned with who people were sleeping with, I think that was actually hidden a little bit more in the Shakespeare and brought out more in this. So I think there was a lot more comedy from who the characters were mistakenly hooking up with. So although I wouldn't consider this a great musical, it was a big improvement on A Comedy of Errors, much more enjoyable for me, much more comic. And I thought it was a good, enjoyable evening that any fan of the golden age of musicals would be well advised to take advantage of, because this musical isn't done very much, but it has some good tunes that you would be well advised to catch being performed live in a fully staged performance while you can.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page in Facebook. On the web, we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.